Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, details of a change of plans for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. We speak with a reporter in Israel about the flare-up in violence there.
You can feel a rather high level of tension, and the media is pretty much around the clock covering the situation.
Hear about Pope Francis offering a vague apology. And we'll listen to the sounds of renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma, coming up right here on The Voice of America. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced that he will slow down the planned withdrawal of American military forces from Afghanistan, previously scheduled for next year. Joining us on the line from the White House is correspondent Aru Pandey. Hi, Aru.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. And you?
Good.
Good. Say, what are the details of the president's plan now in Afghanistan?
Well, basically what the president announced today is that the drawdown will not be taking place as rapidly as he had announced last year. What he had originally proposed was that 1,000 U.S. forces would remain in Afghanistan after 2016, and those troops would be largely based in Kabul to protect the embassy. What we saw announced today is that 5,500, so nearly five times the number of U.S. forces, will now remain in Afghanistan post-2016, and they will not just be in Kabul protecting the embassy, but also in a number of bases, including in Kandahar and other parts of Afghanistan. So the major announcement here is that, look, we're going to continue our withdrawal, but we're not going to do it as fast as we had hoped.
What explanation did he give for this change of policy?
Well, he basically said the security situation is not basically where it should be at. He said Afghanistan is still dangerous, and while he praised Afghan troops, their capabilities, and their ability to basically fight for their own country, he acknowledged that they are not where they should be in terms of their abilities. So he said that the U.S. forces are needed to continue their training and advising mission and also their counterterror missions. He basically said, look, we're not engaged in major ground combat, but they need our help, and they're still not as strong as they need to be. He said that in key areas of Afghanistan, the security situation is still very fragile, and in some cases, there's the risk of deterioration. And we saw that in recent weeks with the Taliban retaking Kunduz, which is a key city, and then obviously Afghan forces were able to take it back. But that was a huge sign and a huge loss, and I think President Obama was able to say, look, this is not where we need to be, and I don't think we can just pull out and just leave 1,000 forces there after 2016.
Were there any signs of the White House that this was coming other than the leak to the media today?
Well, yeah, I mean, they've said for a few weeks now, ever since this whole takeover of Kunduz, that while President Obama does not make snap decisions, he is always mindful of the conditions on the ground, and he's always taking that into account. And you heard President Obama say that today when he was asked after his statement whether he found this decision to be disappointing. President Obama came into office saying he was going to end the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and he basically said he's not into endless war. And he said, look, it's not disappointing. It's an acknowledgement that the security situation is not where it's at, but that he's always going to be willing to make adjustments when necessary, and he might do so again. So there were some signs in recent months that the administration was taking a hard look at the security presence and the troop levels in Afghanistan and was willing to adjust when necessary, and we saw that today.
Well, thank you very much, Haru.
Thank you.
Reaction to Obama's decision to extend the U.S. troop presence in Afghanistan is coming in on Twitter. Social media reporter Michael Lippin joins me now. Michael, what are Obama's domestic critics saying about the move?
Hi, Susan. Well, one of Obama's most prominent critics and opponents is the Republican Speaker of the House, John Boehner. Here's what he tweeted a short time ago. Maintaining the status quo in Afghanistan is not a plan for success. And he linked to a statement in which he says, "The president's half-measures and failed leadership have emboldened our enemies and allowed for the rise of the Islamic State militant group, or ISIL. Obama needs to finally lay out the broad overarching strategy needed to defeat our terrorist enemies and protect the United States." That's Boehner's view. And here's what U.S. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said. He was not quite as negative. His tweet says, "I welcome Obama's decision today not to withdraw all troops from Afghanistan. He learned from such a mistake that the U.S. made in Iraq." And that's a reference to the view of many Republicans that the U.S. military was too quick to pull its troops out of Iraq in 2011, creating a vacuum that they say was exploited by ISIL. Susan?
Thank you, Michael. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Marine ecologists from Australia's University of Adelaide recently conducted a study that predicts a disturbing future for the ocean's food chain. Their study indicated that rising ocean acidification and warming linked to climate change will probably cause a drop in the number and variety of important species that support marine ecosystems throughout the world. According to the study, larger fish that sit atop the ocean's food chain would probably be among the aquatic creatures most affected by this possible breakdown. These are also some of the key species that support the world's fishing industry. The analysis also showed that increasing acidification would lead to a drop in ocean plankton's production of dimethyl sulfide gas. This gas plays a role in Earth's climate by controlling the Earth's heat exchange between the ocean and atmosphere. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Israel has deployed hundreds of soldiers to help police meet the threat of attacks that already have killed at least seven Jews and spread fear throughout the nation as violence escalates between Palestinians and Israelis. Joining us on the line is Ben Hartman with TLV1 FM Radio out of Tel Aviv. Welcome, Ben.
Hi.
What is the situation like in Israel today?
Well, it depends on where in Israel. Obviously, in Jerusalem, the situation is quite a bit more tense and more higher level of alertness, especially in the Sinai neighborhoods, the areas that are along the border with East Jerusalem, or in areas where Jews and Arabs live quite close to one another. But regardless, across the country, there's a higher deployment of police, higher deployment of they also had call-ups of reservists from the army, reservists from the border police, paramilitary police, and even from even prison guards have been called in to help somewhat. So there's a quite noticeable police deployment, mainly in the Jerusalem level, however, and you can feel a rather high level of tension in the media. It's pretty much around the clock covering the situation. But I wouldn't say there's by any means a war situation or something like the Second Intifada when there were suicide bombings and the like. But it's certainly not been normal for the last few days. Definitely not in the capital.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is preparing to head to the Middle East. He's going to explore ways to restore calm amid this wave of violence. What are the expectations of Mr. Kerry?
I would say there are probably no expectations of Mr. Kerry. People have little faith in him on both the Palestinian and the Israeli side. If I were to say, just speaking from the Israeli side, people don't really have any much faith that the Secretary of State would be able to come here and really have any effect on the situation, at least not in a positive sense. So I think if people are looking for ways to feel safer or to have more confidence in the situation, I think they would, at least in Israel, be relying more on the security services as opposed to looking at any sort of confidence that John Kerry could come out here. He's been on quite a few trips out here in the last couple of years, and there haven't been any diplomatic breakthroughs or any real positive changes. Some things are bigger than him, certainly. So I wouldn't put much confidence in that to really change the situation.
Do Israelis have much hope of returning to the status quo anytime soon after this flare-up?
I think so. I think, this isn't the first sort of flare-up like this. There's a higher frequency of attacks than there were in other ones. But about a year ago, last November or so, there was quite a few attacks like this in Jerusalem. There was an attack in a synagogue where four people were killed. There was attack after attack on the light rail and people in bulldozers and cars. So it's not the first one of these flare-ups in recent years. This one's just a higher frequency and in some ways quite a bit more intense. But I think these things, they come and go, and it's a sort of a tragic sort of feature of life that every 6 months to a year or so, maybe more frequently, there's some sort of flare up. But they always tend to end. They don't really go over the brink and really decline into a way to where they can't be controlled. So I would think people can, to a certain extent, go along with their daily lives and be, more careful and more alert, but just have confidence that these things tend to taper off after a little bit.
Well, thank you very much, Ben, for speaking with us today.
Thank you for having me.
In a UN General Assembly vote today, Egypt was elected to become a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council for 2016 through 2017. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Ahmed Fatih, Associated Press correspondent at the UN, about what that would mean for Egypt, and he joins me now. Welcome, Mohamed.
Thank you.
Say, Mohamed, Egypt is a founding member of the UN since October of 1945 and has played a constant role in maintaining international peace. What could Egypt add as a new member in the UNSC?
Well, Sue, as Egypt was lobbying to get the non-permanent seat in the Security Council, it promised to work with other members to strengthen international actions to achieve collective security and stability. And according to Ahmed Fathi, there are benefits and responsibilities associated with this membership.
First, it's a prestige. Second, we would have a say into drafting resolutions or presenting resolutions to the Council for vote. Third, they would chair some of the committees that entrusted by implementation of the various Security Council resolutions that have been issued in the past, whether it's nuclear disarmament, whether it's terrorism sanctions, whether it's Syria, whether it's Yemen. So there is definitely lots of work. In addition, that each of these countries, the 15 member states, they go through a rotating presidency of the Security Council, and then it becomes even more raising for the profile of the country.
Fathi added that when it is Egypt's turn to assume the responsibility of chairing the UN Security Council for 1 month, that international stature could be elevated as Jordan successfully did.
Jordan has proven their high and elite level of practicing multilateral diplomacy, and they have been praised from all countries of the world, whether it's Arab or non-Arab. Egypt can definitely come into the rotating presidency with a strong program if the Egyptian diplomacy would assume a leading role and not just sort of a deja vu or things the rhetoric that they would bring. Of course, there is the rhetoric regarding the Palestinian issue that will be on the agenda of Egypt, but I don't know how strongly they will pursue that. Libya, I think they will presumably try to bring a fresh perspective on it, especially since it's a neighboring country.
Fathi added that Egypt can improve its international image after the military taking over 2 years ago if the professional Egyptian diplomacy was used properly as a non-permanent member of the UN Security Council.
Mohamed, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you very much.
Coming up on International Edition, the Pope says he's sorry, and renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma has a new CD. Pope Francis has offered a rare, if vague, apology for scandals involving the Roman Catholic Church after several high-profile gaffes that were linked to the church or its clergy. Speaking in Rome at the beginning of his weekly general audience, Pope Francis said he asks forgiveness in the name of the Church for the scandals that have recently hit Rome and the Vatican. He did not offer details. The Pope's comments drew applause but also confusion about what he was referring to. A VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Jerome.
Happy to be here, Susan.
Thank you. What scandals might the Pope be referring to?
Nobody really knows. There's been some speculation that it's been about a priest who came out as gay and criticized the church's approach to same-sex marriage. Another possibility is planning for the church's upcoming Jubilee year has been mired in some difficulties.
What kind of difficulties?
Just the planning hasn't gone very well. And some people are also saying the Pope was talking about the mayor of Rome, who recently resigned because criticized that he took a trip to Philadelphia during the Pope's visit to the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, this apology, it seems quite unusual.
It's unusual partly because now we're in the midst of the Synod on the Family, where hundreds of prelates have gathered in Rome and are talking about the church's approach to family issues. They're said to be progressives who want that to change, or certainly want the approach to change. And there was a letter written by conservatives accusing progressives of trying to more or less hijack the meeting.
What is the church's position on families in general? I know it's a huge subject, but can you give me an idea of where they stand?
Well, the two main issues are rejecting and homosexuality and same-sex marriage, open homosexuality, that is. The church is okay if you're homosexual and don't practice it. And the other is toward divorce, toward divorced and remarried Catholics, whether they should be allowed to take communion or not.
Well, you know, this Pope is kind of very unique, don't you think?
He certainly, I would say he's not so unique on church doctrine. He's supported it up till now. He's not said that's changing at all. But he certainly has changed the approach of the church, the style, and wants a more kind of evangelical Christian type of approach where the clergy and leaders are out in the streets, with the people. He talks about a church of the poor, a church of of the slums, really.
And he's charismatic. The people love him. Even non-Catholics think he's a wonderful man.
He has a sense of humor, that's for sure, and he's endeared a lot of people with that. I mean, John Paul also had a sense of humor as well. I mean, I don't want to overstate. There are people who say the media, we in the media, are making more of this Pope than he really is. But he certainly has changed the style of the church. He's really done kind of made a superhuman effort to make it more popular and more relevant to people, especially people who disagree with its teachings.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jerome, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
This is VOA.
From science and technology, here's what's new.
What's new? It's a glass-bottom bridge, the first in China, in central Hunan province. 180 meters high, 300 meters long, and strung between two cliffs in Shenujiai Park. It's attracting thousands of tourists every day, like Chu Zhegao. I'm challenging myself, he says. I just walked from over there, but I never looked down. You each his own to find the way across. Hold onto the rail, grab your friend in front of you, and make a human train. Or just get down on your hands and knees if you must. And if you make it over this bridge, there's an even bigger one on the way in Hunan province. At a planned 430 meters long and 300 meters high, the new bridge will likely be the world's tallest and longest when it opens in Zhangjiajie Park in 2016. For VOA's What's New, I'm Martin Seacrest.
Renowned cellist Yo-Yo Ma celebrated his 60th birthday this month and has a new CD that takes a musical, contemplative look at life. David Byrd reports.
There are few accolades that Yo-Yo Ma has not received in his storied career. A multiple Grammy winner, Ma has also been a Kennedy Center honoree, has been awarded the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, and has won the U.S. National Medal of Arts. On his new CD, Songs from the Arc of Life, the cellist uses classical pieces by Bach, Debussy, Tchaikovsky, and others to take listeners through several emotional ages. Ma says his intent was to record a soundtrack for life's most important moments.
Everybody goes through hard times, good times. And when you go through any one of those times, extreme moments, there's usually some music associated with it. You know, first date, first kiss, you know. It's like moments where, or grief, first loss. And so we kind of compiled something that goes from beginning to end and took knowledge that no matter how focused we are at any moment in our lives, that it is part of a larger whole. And how, in the end, do we want that life to be?
The cellist says that turning 60 is an important milestone for him, but it also gives him the freedom to be who he really is and not someone that other people want him to be.
I don't live compartments. I'm basically always myself. You know, it's not like, okay, I have to be really polite or I have to do this. No, I'll just say what I think is true and do what I think is right. And not worry about, you know, someone saying, well, that's stupid, you know, because, okay, if you think it's stupid, you know, I can't help it. You know, it's like, I'm just going to try and do my best.
Yo-Yo Ma has been playing the cello since he was only 4. His parents were both musical. His mother was a singer and his father a violinist and professor of music. Despite the exacting demands of playing the classical repertoire, Yo-Yo Ma says that he actually finds serenity in playing, even the difficult pieces.
So I view sort of performing like the moments before you fall asleep or right when you wake up, and you're sort of half, you're half dreaming, half awake, and you have these great ideas that come to your mind and you try and write them down, because if you don't, you forget them, because you have temporary access. And having that access puts you in this very, very wonderful state.
Yo-Yo Ma and Catherine Scott will perform in Japan and Taiwan in October and November in support of the new CD. U.S. stops on their tour include the Palladium in Carmel, Indiana, and Boston's Symphony Hall. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at @VOA_IE. If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
In its continuing effort to assist other nations in confronting terrorism and protecting American citizens and interests, the United States is offering rewards to find 2 key operatives of an extremist group operating in Afghanistan, Hezb-e-Islami Gulbuddin, or HIG. HIG is an insurgent group that conducts attacks against the Afghan government and coalition forces. It has espoused virulently anti-American ideologies and seeks to overthrow the Afghan government. Abdul Sabur is an explosives expert associated with HIG who was responsible for the May 16, 2013 suicide vehicle-borne improvised explosive device attack in Kabul, Afghanistan. The attack killed 2 U.S. soldiers, 4 U.S. civilian contractors, and 8 Afghans, including 2 children, wounded at least 37 others, and destroyed a U.S. armored vehicle. Sabur and HIG explosives expert Abdullah Nabahar were key participants in the September 18, 2012 suicide attack against a bus carrying 4 employees of a firm that provided aviation services to the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. More than a dozen people were killed, and nearly a dozen more were injured in the attack. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $3 million for information leading to Sabur's arrest or conviction, and up to $2 million for information leading to the arrest or conviction of Nabahar. The U.S. guarantees that all reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on either of these men, contact the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or phone 1-800-877-3927. Individuals in Afghanistan may call the tip line at 0700-108-600.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.